Hello, welcome to this week's Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, and I introduce the show each week and talk to a wide range of guests from the world of integrative medicine for cancer. I'm also the founder of the registered UK charity Yes to Life that has, for the last 15 years, helped people with cancer to find out about their options within integrative medicine. My guest today has been on the show before. He's a mine of information about prostate cancer. Peter Starr has a new book out summarising his findings right up to date, and this has prompted me to contact him at his home in California to find out some more. Peter, really great to have you back on the show again.
It's great, and thanks for the consideration. I appreciate it.
So, today we're talking about your new book, Prostate Cancer, Why We Get It, What to Do About It. So, in the front of the book, you describe yourself as Medical Research Director of the Healing Arts Education Foundation. Well, could you tell us how that qualifies you to write a book with a confident statement on the front announcing that it's got the answers to why men get prostate cancer and what they can do about it?
Well, I think we have to go back a little further than that. I was diagnosed with prostate cancer 16 years ago, 2004. Mm-hmm. And when the doctor told me, first of all, they did a biopsy, which we don't recommend today, but I didn't know any better then. I just did what the doctor told me. And they did a biopsy and came up with a Gleason score of 7, which people that know, that's one step away from what they consider to be aggressive. And I started to do some research. They wanted to do surgery like immediately. And I started to do some research and said, this really doesn't sound like a way I need to go with this particular problem. And continued to do the research and continued to avoid the doctor. They did a couple of scans to make sure that it hadn't spread beyond the prostate, and it hadn't. Mm-hmm. And I felt confident enough with that and with the rate of research that I was doing and the people that I was consulting at the time to continue without conventional medical treatment. And it's been that way now 16 years. And,
right.
During that time, I've kept fairly good notes of the doctors that I've spoken to and the subjects we talked about. And even though I have no formal medical training, what I find is that common sense and listening to people that have had that formal training goes an awful long way. Because what I've also found is that you may have a doctor with MD after his name. It doesn't mean to say he knows what he's talking about. And I found a fair amount of that over the years in the medical profession. Some of them are like automatrons, if that's the correct word, where they just follow the line. And I've come across that a lot. And even in the talks that I've given in America, sometimes doctors will come up and talk to me and challenge me. And I find out very quickly they just haven't done their research.
All right.
And I think the concept is you don't have to be a doctor to do research. And I'm not a young man anymore. I wasn't even young when I got diagnosed. I was 61 when I was diagnosed. I'm 77 now. Mm-hmm. And I'm still very healthy. I still live a full life, except for this virus issue that we've got plaguing the country at the moment. And I still ride motorcycles at speeds that some people would consider to be totally insane. And as we talked about early on, I'm taking on new things like learning to play the guitar. So I have no complaints about my life. I have no complaints about the road that I chose to travel. And by knowing all of these doctors and I've known them for a long time, I did a documentary series, which is also out here in America, that's sold by our foundation, and it's called Surviving Prostate Cancer Without Surgery, Drugs, and Radiation, and it contains the wisdom of 56 doctors from 8 countries on 3 continents. And that was the first thing I did, and I produced a documentary primarily because for the last 35 years, that's what I've been doing for a living, producing documentaries mainly for American television. One or two have come across the Atlantic and been shown in the UK, particularly on channels 4 and 5. But that's been about it. And then I produced this documentary. It's 3 DVDs. It's quite a long thing. And it's an educational thing. It's not made to win awards so much as with pizzazz. It's meant to really get people's minds wrapped around a different concept of treating prostate cancer by utilizing all of the knowledge from these great doctors, put together in what I consider to be a simple, easy way for men to sit in front of the television set and really take a good look at what their options are. Mm-hmm. And that led, of course, later on to the writing of this book. So the book is the very latest of things that I've done. And I wrote it, but I also wrote it based on all of the experience of the doctors that I mentioned in the documentary and others that I've met since the documentary that have become part of my life, like, for instance, Jonathan Wright. He's a doctor you might have heard of. He's very highly regarded in America. And people like that. So it's the very latest thing, and it contains the very latest information about prostate cancer, including some things that you're able to do in the UK, which we're not able to do here in America yet. So I find, quite honestly, that we're quite a ways behind in conventional medicine for some things like prostate cancer treatments that are more of the more conventional style, conventional type. I think we're pretty well ahead of a lot of people when it comes to what you might call alternative treatments.
Yes. That's interesting. Well, we'll come back to that because I definitely want to investigate that a bit more. So, great. So it's a very informative book, as you say. It's very easy to read. It's brilliant, the way it's packed so much into a slim volume, I think. But we men, we're kind of legendary for not being overly interested in health, and we're generally even less interested in talking about it. But things have moved a little in the last few decades to the extent that quite a lot of us now are aware that we got a prostate, and we're even prepared to talk about it occasionally, though far less of us know where it is, what it's for, and why it can be so much bother. Do you want to just set out the territory?
Well, I first got interested or knew about the prostate when my father was diagnosed with prostate cancer about 25 years ago now. As you know, and you may have gathered from my voice, I'm an expat Brit, or whatever they call it, living in California, but born and raised in England. And my father got prostate cancer, and about the same age that I got it, actually. Hmm. No, he's a little older. He would have been about 68, 69 at the time. But they gave him a drug called flutamide as a way to, quote, control the prostate. Well, of course, it didn't. And as we well know today, and the side effects are more apparent today perhaps than they were in those days, is that flutamide cuts off testosterone. It's an androgen deprivation drug, and the side effects of that is your muscles decrease and your bones shrink, and in the end you become a very small person with no weight, you know, no weight, no strength. And that happened to my father, who was over 6 feet when he started, and it's quite a lot less when he actually passed away and was very skinny. But what caused his death was the biggest muscle that he gets to deal with was his heart, and he had a heart attack.
Right.
And on the death certificate, it said myocardial infarction. And I thought for the longest time he died of a heart attack. In reality, what he did was he died from the side effects, or I call them direct effects, of taking flutamide. And I found that out when I started to do my research of what am I going to do about it. And I thought, well, let's go look and see what they were giving my dad. And I looked at the medical records, and that's how I found out about that. And that was one of the first triggers for me to say, I've got to do a lot more research into this that is obviously being told to me by my own urologist here in America. Hmm. And so that's how I learned about the where the prostate was and what it was. And then when I got diagnosed, and by the way, my PSA when I was diagnosed was 1.2,
right?
Which most doctors would never think about as anything unusual. I mean, that was pretty healthy. The trouble is that what we know now is about 30% of men that get prostate cancer get it with a low PSA.
Right.
And so that was another clue. The PSA is not to be relied upon as a indicator of cancer, and we know now that it's not an indicator of cancer at all. And we also know that it's not even prostate specific anymore. And when I read today, I was up quite early this morning waiting for your call, and I actually read a thing from an English product that's trying to be sold over here, a prostate supplement, and they're still saying that the PSA is an indicator of cancer. And it just is not. It's an indicator of inflammation. And so these are other indicators that bit by bit over the years have come up that I've learned. I'm going, wow, we knew virtually nothing back in 2004 when I got the disease and 15 years earlier than that when my dad had the disease.
Right.
And so I find it an act of responsibility, not just to me, to cure myself and take care of myself, but also to pass that information along to people that still listen only to their own doctor or urologist, who, quite honestly, most of the times are just not up to date. And if they are up to date, it's only with a very narrow view of what prostate cancer is. And the knowledge is out there. And what I've tried to do is not only talk about it in the documentary that we produced, but actually condense it into this book.
Right. Okay, so tell us a bit more about the prostate and why it tends to give trouble in later life for so many men, and what its function is.
Well, to start out with the basics, the prostate's a gland and a muscle. And we know what happens with muscles when you don't use them, that they atrophy. We also know that the prostate is made up of a material, a fatty material, that attracts toxins. And so quite often when you get prostate cancer, you can do scans and realize that you've got, or even high PSAs, and look at your prostate and realize you've got toxins in there, such as calcium. Calcification of the prostate is actually quite common. And that can be a high irritant, causing inflammation, which because of the inflammation will then set up a cascade of things within the prostate, which eventually ends up in cancer. Not always, but can, and often does. So the concept is to find out, you know, the prostate is a muscle that is used to contract semen for ejaculation. It's also the controller of the urine going from the bladder down through the penis. And there's that little tube called the urethra is critical, because if the prostate expands, either because of cancer or because of benign prostatic hyperplasia, that actual urethra can actually close off or get very, very small. It becomes harder and harder to urinate. And if it closes off completely, you'll have urine retention, where the urine backs up into the bladder expands, the urine backs up through the tubes that go to the kidneys, and you get kidney failure.
Mm.
So the prostate becomes very, very important in terms of getting rid of that urine, which is getting rid also of a lot of toxins in your body that are processed through the kidneys. So keeping a healthy prostate is really important. Now, I didn't know anything about this back in the day before I got diagnosed, and very few men do.
Right.
And it's important to understand that you can actually prevent a lot of this by your diet, your lifestyle, the emotional trauma that you live in your life. Things you know, that we don't, as men, discuss very often, if at all, until we get diagnosed with something that's critical. And then you've really got to do your research. Otherwise, you'll go along with the doctors, you'll have your prostate removed, and you'll be a candidate for impotence, incontinence, and by the way, the return of the cancer.
Right.
So when you get to be 45 or 50, it's about time to take account of what the prostate is and what the issues are, because as you get older, the more difficult it is to make those changes. Make the changes early. Try to avoid the entire issue of either prostate expansion through benign prostatic hyperplasia or, heaven forbid, cancer.
Right. Okay. And it's important to differentiate between those two, BPH and cancer. Would it be correct to say that one is just a case of inflammation and the other one's actually malignant?
Well, yes. And there's other issues as well involved. We might get into some of the diagnostics in a minute, but benign is exactly what it is. It's benign. It is not cancerous, but it's a growth, and it can be quite dangerous. From what I told you about blocking off the urethra,
yes,
and then the urine backing up into the kidneys,
hmm,
and as we all know, kidney disease not only can be fatal, but it can scar you for life. I mean, you can end up in a hospital on dialysis. And you'll have that for the rest of your life unless you get a kidney transplant. But so those are issues that we need to sort of stress very early on, is to take care of that. And if you start to get symptoms like that, get conventional medical help immediately, because if not, you're dealing with something a lot more, in my opinion, a lot more serious than cancer, because it can happen very, very quickly.
Right.
Whereas prostate cancer generally is a much slower process. And you have some time to do research, you have time to experiment, you have time to discuss it with other doctors, get second or third or fourth opinions on what you should be doing. And that's what I would recommend if I ever had it. Well, I've had it and did it, but I tell this to a lot of people. I have consultations here. People call me and ask me what I should do. I've got a PSA of 14, and but I'm peeing okay. My urination seems to be fine, but the doctor wants me to go have a biopsy, and they put the panic and the fear into you. When in fact, there's a number of steps one should take before you get to that point. But as I'm finding, as I talk to English doctors and English patients, and I do have some consultations from England, is that some things are just not available on the NHS, and people, a lot of people don't have the money to get private treatments.
Yeah, that's true.
And we do a thing over here called a 3D color Doppler ultrasound, which is available through our own health insurance here. Mm. And the reason we do that is, I'll give you an example. I had a patient a couple of months ago call me up. He had a 14.5 on his PSA score and was petrified of having a biopsy. And I get a phone call from him and I say, is there anything I can do? And I said, yes, you go have a 3D color Doppler ultrasound done and let that doctor take a look at what's actually going on in the prostate. And the reason I do that is twofold. One is, with the 3D color Doppler, you can actually see the blood flow in the prostate. You can measure it. Right. And if the the doctor sees on the scan that there is a dark spot which might be cancer, they can tell with pretty accurate results as to whether or not that is cancerous by the amount of blood flow that's going through. Mm-hmm. And if there's a significant amount of blood flow over and above the norm, there's a fair chance that that's cancer. If there's no significant blood flow, chances are it's benign or some other issue. But even if then if he says, look, I think you probably have cancer, you've got a choice. You've not had a biopsy, so you've not disturbed the prostate, and you can say, I think I'm going to go and try this naturally and give it some time, like maybe 6 months, and do a sincere job of changing your entire lifestyle, dealing with your diet, dealing with your emotional trauma, dealing with your testosterone levels, things like that that need to be done. Give it 6 months. If it hasn't changed, then maybe you might want to think of another way of doing things. In the meantime, of course, science itself is making some horrendous changes for the positive when it comes to prostate cancer. And there's a process we could discuss in a minute about some of those. But the idea is, if you haven't done the biopsy, but the doctor that does the 3D color Doppler says, I think I see something there, and it's likely to be cancer, the blood flow is this and that. And you can see this live. This isn't something you have to wait for a result. You see this live on a TV screen. Hmm. And you make the decision that, well, if I'm going to go natural, I'm ahead of the game because I've not had a biopsy and I've not got some of the side effects of biopsies. But if you want to go conventional, they will do a biopsy because they will not treat you conventionally without having a biopsy, particularly in this country where it's a legal requirement for a pathologist. Well, you need to have a pathologist look at a sample, and again, it's an opinion, but he will see cells in there and he will say, yes, you have cancer, you have this type of cancer, and that's where they come up with the Gleason score. And anything above 7 is considered to be aggressive, 4 to 7 is moderate, and under 4, they don't really pay that much attention anymore. But you get a choice. You say, I'm not going to do the conventional way, and I'm going to give myself 6 months to do it, to start work on a natural way. And if you see an improvement, and most people do, then you're ahead of the game. Mm-hmm. You've not disturbed the prostate, not punctured 12 holes at 1.5 millimeters, going into the prostate. There's a very famous quote in my documentary from a Scotsman who lives in London, actually, and an Americans find his accent humorous, to say the least. And I don't do a Scottish accent very well, but he says, I'll give you an interpretation. He says, oh, hey, you've got this prostate, it's about the size of a walnut, and they put 12 holes in it. My prostate's never been the same since, and he just goes on like this.
Right.
And his prostate never got over it.
Right.
And he continued to have damage in the prostate.
Right.
And what I try to do is initially to try to avoid that.
Yeah.
Now, if the patient decides to go conventionally and do surgery, drugs, or any kind of radiation therapies, then they will do a biopsy because that's just the way they do it. And there's no way around that.
I think the same story here. Well, look, let's just talk about conventional medicine for a minute. For decades, you know, over-treatment was rife. Prostates were whipped out on the smallest suspicion. Radiation was administered in a kind of cavalier manner. And many of these poor men were left to suffer the devastating consequences and often still died of the disease a little later. Thankfully, there's a bit more restraint around now with, you know, watchful waiting, active surveillance. But while many men still receive treatments that have been around for years, there are actually some new kids on the block which seem to offer a better ratio between their harm and their help than some of their predecessors. Could you sum up what you think are the most promising avenues in conventional treatment at the moment?
Well, I think you have to consider HIFU. Personally, I've seen not good things with HIFU, but generally speaking, I've seen some good things. I've spoken to doctors that practice HIFU, and what they do is it's done under general anesthetic. Although it's an outpatient, you don't stay overnight in the hospital. It's done in a clinic, and they put you out, and they put a probe into the rectum right up against the prostate, and they pound the prostate with ultrasound. And it's pretty accurate. They can map out the prostate, and it will kill cancer cells. And officially in America, they say it's not officially approved for cancer treatment. It's officially approved for prostate ablation.
Right.
Well, if you ablate the prostate cells, you get rid of the cancer.
Right.
It's a technical thing, but it's being used as a cancer treatment here. The other thing that I've heard great success for, in fact, your own Mark Emberton in London has been raving about this. I don't know whether it's yet available in the UK, is photodynamic therapy.
Right.
And not the conventional photodynamic therapy, which was developed at Harvard, and they still do in China, they still do it in Mexico. They do not do it in America. It's never been approved here for prostate cancer, only approved for cancers that are beneath the skin by 1.5 centimeters. So certain skin cancers, basically, it is approved in America for that. But essentially what they do is, in the conventional photodynamic therapy, is give you a sensitizer, which you take orally, and then the next morning you go back in to get oxygenated, either through exercise or through inhaling the oxygen. And then they put you into a light bed and pound the body with a certain kind of light. Well, the real problem with that is that it's good for, say, the light goes in about 1.5 centimeters into the body and does effectively cure certain types of cancers that are that close to the skin. But the prostate is pretty deep. It's surrounded by a lot of muscle, and it didn't work for prostate cancer at all that I know of, even though they use it in China and they use it in Mexico. But they did change it a little bit, and they started to activate the sensitizer, and when it reached the prostate, with audio sounds, high-frequency sound. And they did that by, again, putting a receptor into the rectum up against the prostate. And that has some success. But what the Israelis have done, which I find quite exciting, and it's now being marketed through a Belgian company called Steva Biotech, is they developed an entirely new sensitizer, which is also done under general anesthetic. It takes about an hour and a half, and you're in and out the same day, so there's no overnight stay in the hospital. But they go into the prostate the same way that they do with brachytherapy, that is through the perineum. And they put some needles in that way right into the prostate, and they introduce the sensitizer right into the prostate. And then they activate it by introducing light through the very same optical tubes that they put into the prostate. And that causes starvation of blood to the cancer, and the cancer dies. And they withdraw the needles, and you're on your way. And this figures the success rate that I've read about this from this Israeli company and through Steva Biotech are quite remarkable. And I believe it is available in Germany. I heard through something that I read about Mark Emberton saying that it's going to be made available in the UK. I don't know if that's true yet or not. But I'm more excited about that than anything else that's conventional.
Well, it sounds good. I mean, I'm a huge fan of PDT. It's been sidelined in Britain ridiculously, despite the fact we're real pioneers in its development. And it's a very effective treatment. If you can get a laser anywhere near a tumour, it's a great treatment, and it's cheap and it's repeatable. But it's got, nonetheless, it's just too kind of off the main beat, you know, for the mainstream medicine to adopt. And, you know, there's just too much investment in all the conventional ways of approaching solid tumours, I think. And this literally represented a kind of threat to the status quo, I think. That's my interpretation of why it's never taken off the way I think it should.
Well, I don't disagree with you. And that brings us to another subject, though, is, you know, how much is invested in existing technologies and the training of doctors to do those traditional technologies and the retraining of them to do something different.
Right.
And what I found is you not only have to retrain them, you have to retrain them in thinking, the way they think about it.
Right.
And that's perhaps in some ways more difficult than the physical aspect of retraining doctors. And when you've been told that that a certain system exists and it's for the best and so on and so forth, and that's been done for decades, such as testosterone as an example. I mean, if you remember back in the early 60s, they thought they found the reason for prostate cancer as being high testosterone. And for years and years and years, doctors were given testosterone deprivation drugs, androgen deprivation drugs. But it wasn't curing the problem.
Right.
And then when Abraham Morgenthaler, the doctor that's the head of urology for Harvard Medical School and also in private practice, when he started to do the research, he found out that all the research that had been parroted from the early 60s was actually all based on one patient.
Really?
But what Abraham Morgenthaler, who's a high-level doctor at Harvard University, said, this doesn't make any sense. And he started to do the research, and he went back to all the original papers that were written back in the early 60s, and he said, this is nonsense. And he rethought the entire process. And when I visited with him at his facility in Boston and interviewed him for my documentary, he was telling me he has over 100 patients in his private practice there that are taking testosterone.
Mm.
He's actually either giving it to them orally or injecting it. And he said, I've got a much happier bunch of patients, and it has not affected the cancer in any way. And patients are much happier being men again rather than being eunuchs.
Right.
Because that's what happens when you take testosterone out of the system, because testosterone is not just a sex hormone. It's essential for your bone structure and for your muscular structure.
Right.
And so you found you have much happier men than they had before. So he has a book called Testosterone for Life, which goes into much more detail, obviously, than I did in my book. I just took the essence of what he said in the documentary and out of his book and condensed that as a chapter in my book. But I find that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a way that in the very beginning of the research on testosterone, with only one patient, it was decided that testosterone was the problem.
Right.
And it spread from there. And so all of a sudden, it was the standard of care.
Mm.
And I find that, it's not funny, it's just ridiculous. But anyway, thanks to Abraham Morgenthaler, who had the common sense, basically, to look at this and say himself, I don't think this is the right thing, and then back it up with solid research. And he's quite a prominent doctor over here now, partially because of that. But even today, I come across doctors that will argue that point, in spite of all the research that he's done, because they're so invested in the old system. And when you tell them it was based on only one case, there was three patients that were actually taken off testosterone. Two of them, it didn't make a lot of difference to, because they died of something else earlier. But the one patient that the papers were built on, were written and the whole process was built on, you can't control an entire population of disease with one patient's anecdotal results.
Mm.
But they did.
Right.
And it just spread. And so it was taken as gospel. They told me that when I got diagnosed. And I took it as gospel because I didn't know any better. Mm. It's only when you do the research that you realize that these people are just not up to date at all.
Right. Okay, one thing I'd like to explore with you a little bit, one of the things that's sort of often taken as a given amongst people who are in this field is that the orthodox approach to cancer is very much one of killing cancer cells, removing cancer cells. It sees the cancer cells as the enemy, and therefore if you get rid of them, you've got rid of the problem. Whereas integrative medicine tends to look much broader and see it as a systemic issue, and you need to fix the system, otherwise you haven't actually fixed the problem. And a lot of the resources you're pointing to, like what you were talking about earlier, when we were talking about people going the natural route, these are systemic approaches. Now, I'd interested to hear what your view on the place of these two different approaches, which, they could be said to both have their place in different circumstances in different times. How do you see that?
Well, I believe that prostate cancer is a lifestyle disease primarily. Mm-hmm. And I much prefer to talk to people about changing their lifestyle. Now, to me, there's like a four-pronged approach. You've got to get your body working properly. And there's usually people that have prostate cancer have other issues involved. And I think it's very much a way you've got to determine what is the overall problems with the body and correct them. Yeah, that's the number one. Mm-hmm. Number two is that most of us are carrying around a high toxic load. If you've got cancer, you're carrying around a high toxic load. Particularly with prostate cancer, where we have a lot of heavy metal interaction, nickel, cadmium, mercury in particular, and we find those in the prostate, and you need detoxification of that. So getting rid of the toxins, making the body healthy from all the other elements. The third thing is the hormones. Most men with prostate cancer do have low testosterone, mm. and they see an improvement when they start taking testosterone. And that is, I've got that opinion based on everything I've read of Abraham Morgenthaler. I personally have taken testosterone, and mm-hmm. I'm still here 16 years later, still okay. healthy. I mean, still doing everything that a man likes to do. Not often enough, I might add. I'm 77, but still doing it. But and that's an important. And the fourth thing, which most people until very, very recently have totally ignored, and that's what I call dealing with the emotional traumas. I believe that we can have an emotional situation in our bodies that will bring on cancer, and I believe you can have an emotional cure for that. And I think it's very, very important in my four-pronged approach to address the emotional trauma issue. And that's, you find when you really dig into that, people are in bad relationships, they wallow about in unhealthy emotional issues, and all of that needs to be cleaned up. And I found a couple of people to be very helpful in that regard. Gilbert Renaud, who's a French-Canadian doctor, he has a system called Recall Healing. Mm-hmm. There's the certain aspects of German New Medicine. You're probably more familiar with that. Mm-hmm. And even certain amounts of hypnosis. There's a gentleman in the UK that I've been getting to know lately called Dorian Studley, who does a certain hypnotic kind of treatment. And I'm not saying you should do that on its own, but certainly as an adjunct to the other three things that we talked about, it's very important. If you don't deal with the emotional issues in your life, you'll just come back to relive them. And that's another reason why I think the disease hangs around a lot, is because people aren't dealing with the emotion side of their life. They're only dealing with taking the supplements or getting their diet right, or they're not dealing with the hormone base, or they're not getting rid of the toxins. To me, it's a group thing that has to be done.
Right. And then, so that's primarily, you're saying, how you like to look at cancer, but then there you have orthodox medicine. And do you feel that there are times when cancer killing or removal of cancer is appropriate or needed or fits in?
Yes, I mean, there are people that just can't deal with changing their lifestyle. I mean, that's a fact. They don't want to, they don't feel they can do it, they refuse to do it, and they're going to go for conventional medicine of some sort. But if you look logically at the treatment you're getting, and the odds of the cancer coming back after the prostate's been removed or after it's been radiated. And I mean, then we talk about over here about proton beam therapy. Yeah. I don't know whether that's something that's done in the UK
it
or not.
Is. Yes,
but it's done here, and they claim amazing results. But I've spoken to some patients, and I've found that what happened to them is they blew those protons right through the prostate, right into the bowel, and very much similar results in terms of the after effects that you get from conventional treatment, from conventional radiation. They also said that in the very beginning, when they got the Da Vinci robotic prostate removal, that it would have less side effects and you'd have a much better life thereafter. Well, what they're finding out now is, of course, that the side effects they've got, which is including the return of the cancer, is very, very similar to the radical prostatectomy of old. Time tells amazing things about treatments, and it's very much like the supplements that are on the market today. They claim amazing things, and very few of them actually deliver. And I think men that have cancer need to be educated. They need to have a good basis to make the decision as to what kind of treatment they want. Some people don't have the appetite or the patience to deal with alternative or integrative treatments, and they basically say, "Let's get it out of me." In fact, there's a statistic that says that 70% of the men that have a radical prostatectomy, whether it's done with a Da Vinci or the open surgery, they make that decision within 48 hours of the diagnosis.
Wow.
In other words, they don't think of anything beyond get that damn thing out of me.
Right.
And I find that very sad.
Yeah, I would agree. So it's interesting because, you know, whether there's a place for conventional methods or not, you're actually saying, and I agree with you, that there's always a place for the lifestyle change, because otherwise you basically have left your system in the same state it was in before you got cancer.
Absolutely. And in fact, a number of the people that I get telephone calls from are people that have had conventional treatment. It hasn't worked. The cancer might be back, or they're suffering from other things, and they call up, what do I know that can help them?
Mm.
Well, of course, the only thing I know is to actually change their lifestyle and go through the four-step process that I've laid out. I've laid it out in the book in some detail.
Yeah.
And because they thought when they went into surgery that that would be the end of it. They take out the prostate, it's gone.
Yeah.
Well, no, because you haven't resolved the issue that brought on the cancer in the first place.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's very clear, and it actually makes complete sense to anybody, I think, that who's not completely and utterly tunnel vision on one particular thing, curing it. So I want to come back on something you've already mentioned. I mentioned earlier that the men's number one strategy in relation to health issues, like avoidance and denial, is the number one. But within that, out of your four steps that you set out there, the male strategy is almost universal when it comes to the emotional life and mental well-being. You know, that's definitely somewhere we don't go. So if you put that out as one of the four strategies that women needed to take with regard to breast cancer, then I think they would probably take to it relatively easily, most of them. But men, it's a no. It's, you know, the E word is basically somewhere where they don't want to go. So, you know, you've dedicated a whole chapter to it, and you put it on the same level as the three other things that they should be addressing. And I think that's very interesting. It's interesting that you, within this book, which has all sorts of very satisfyingly male charts and tables of data and all that to satisfy the intellect, but you're also saying, look, men, you need to wake up and do something about this whole area of the emotional life, which can cause so much trouble. I applaud you for putting it in the book. I would agree with you. Do you want to say some more about what avoidance of this area can mean?
Well, I think if you choose to go, if you, either way you go, whether it's conventional or, as I call it, alternative, I think you have to tackle all four issues. Let me go back to the emotional side a second. You know, men today have had the masculinity kicked out of them over the years, certainly over the past 30, 40 years, I think, by the way that things have happened in society generally. We're not the men we used to be. And I'm not saying it's good or bad or indifferent. I'm just saying we're not. Okay. We don't do the same things we used to do. We're belittled by the media today through being, if we were to be the men of old, we're certainly belittled by that. We can see it today, even with this coronavirus thing. I don't want to get into that specifically, but we can see it today with the way that's being handled and the way men are being sort of kicked around about trying to be men with the whole thing. And that, to me, is a huge issue. The prostate is a male organ, and it is an integral part of what makes us men, the masculinity in us. And you see this so often when the prostate gets removed, it changes the whole center of where men are. And we've had that done to us over the last 40, 50 years anyway. And to add that is like adding insult to injury. So I think that's an aspect of the emotional side of things. We need to come back to being the men that we were. And it doesn't mean to say we don't have to be considerate of other people and so on. That's not what it's about at all. But there is a certain responsibility of being men that has gone. And I felt it, and I see it today, and it's part of what I talk about. And the people that address that much better than I've listed in the book, are people that practice like German New Medicine, or Dorian Stoodley, or Recall Healing, or even a process called Psyche. Now, I learned about Psyche through Bruce Lipton. You've probably heard of Bruce Lipton. Mm-hmm. I spent 4 days with Bruce before I even interviewed him, to learn about who he was, what he was, how he came to the conclusions he came to, and so on. And that led to a whole section on a process called Psyche, which I've devoted to quite a large section in the book to, in the emotional chapter. But I've got to give credit to Bruce Lipton to turning me on to a lot of things about emotion many years ago now, back when basically most people had not really heard of Bruce Lipton too much. Now he's a common household name amongst alternative medical people, and I think has a world renown for what his beliefs are. And it's solid research. The man is not only brilliant, but he's done a lot of solid research.
Yes.
And when I learned about what he knew, I then learned about Psyche, and that went on to learn about Recall Healing and German New Medicine. There's a lot of material out there, and if men that have, before they even get to prostate cancer, before they even get to benign prostatic hyperplasia or prostatitis or any of those things, be aware of all of this. Because men don't. Men, generally speaking, don't do anything until the cancer hits, and then they'll go to the doctor. But it's just the way we are. Mm. And I was that way. My dad was that way. And I still see that in men today. And yet, on the other hand, when the doctor says, "You need to have that removed," the man will say, "It's Tuesday too soon. Can we do it? You know, let's just get it out." And it's a male trait today, I'm afraid. We don't do the kind of thinking that I was hoping to encourage. But it's changing, but it's awfully slow.
Mm. Well, I do think there's a lot of that. If you like, the downsides of maleness are associated with our relationship to the feeling and emotion area, which this tendency to not go near it, to feel that it's unmasculine to do so, or dangerous in some way. I think it's to our detriment. And it's interesting to hear what you say about maleness. There's a huge focus on the negatives of maleness, if you like, these days. Not for for any bad reason. I mean, there's nothing good about those things, but there's not a similar focus, if you like, on the positives of maleness. I think men generally don't feel too good about themselves, you know, and that is associated, I think, with that whole feeling of being a man that you're talking about, and that it's actually good to be a man. I think you're right. There's some kind of cultural issues that are dovetailing with deeper ongoing things that men have had forever.
There's an interesting study I read some time ago about different countries and the way prostate cancer is, and I only ever refer to prostate cancer, I wouldn't extend this to other diseases, although I think sometimes it's a valid point, is you go to countries where prostate cancer is low, mm-hmm. and men have a different opinion of themselves. They have a different way of fitting into their society than we do in the Western world. I mean, you look at the high levels of prostate cancer, Sweden and Switzerland and the UK and Germany and America, of course, and Canada, New Zealand and Australia. And then you go to Japan and you go to some other countries where prostate cancer is quite low. And men live a different kind of life. Same with Africa. Men are different there. And their rates of prostate cancer are significantly lower. Now, some of that, I believe, has to do with toxicity. Some of it has to do with diet. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of it has to do with the whole male issue. And I don't feel qualified enough to sort of give advice on that. But there are people out there, as I mentioned in the book, that if that's an issue, these are the people to talk to. And they're the people I went to, and that's how I learned about it. I just don't feel qualified to advise people specifically and treat them myself. I just am an educator in terms of pointing people in the right direction.
Right. All right. Well. As I say, I feel it's great that you've actually given it due attention in your new book. So look, we're out of time. It's been really interesting to talk to you about your book. Congratulations on getting it all together. I think it's a great resource for men. I don't think it's actually out in the UK, but presumably we can order it from the States.
You can, and if I may say, we're on the website. It's called survivingprostatecancer.org. In America, the .org is because we're a charity. We're what we call a 501c3 not-for-profit charity. Mm-hmm. And the book is, along with the videos that we have, the way that we fund the charity. We don't charge for consultations at this point, but we're going to have to pretty soon because it's just getting more and more expensive to run charities, even in this country. Mm. But if you go to survivingprostatecancer.org, there's a lot of information on that website. We're currently rebuilding the website. Hopefully it'll be done within a month or so, and everything will be available through there. And if I can encourage people to go there, to order the book, order the DVDs. We already sell, by the way, DVDs to people in the UK. Now, so there is quite an interest in it. We don't sell them in vast quantities because we're not really well known in the UK, but people find us on the internet. Hopefully they'll find us with the book, and hopefully we'll be able to arrange for some distribution in the UK for this book, because I think any man age 45 and up needs to have this information at his hand.
All right, there's the message. Thank you very much, Peter.
Robin, it's been great. I love talking to you, and good luck with your charity in the UK, and let's keep these fires burning.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Robin.
Okay,
bye-bye now. Thanks, bye-bye.
Do take a look at the resources on offer from survivingprostatecancer.org. On the site itself, on video, and of course Peter's book. It's valuable stuff. I want to remind you that our new Wigwam initiative is getting into gear. Wigwam is an established support group forum set up last year by our executive director, Sue De Cesare, with local groups in several locations. In response to the lockdown, we've now started regular online forums, each of which features an expert guest and each of which is recorded and made available to anyone who signs up as a member through the Wigwam website, which is just being launched at wigwam.org.uk. Keep an eye on my social media and on Yes to Life for details of upcoming Wigwam forums. Thanks so much for joining me today. It's always a real pleasure to be able to bring so much helpful information and resource to you through the show. I hope you'll be able to listen to next week's Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.